Hello. On this podcast, we talk about movies, their faults, their flaws, and their plots. So, expect some spoilers.
You've been warned.
Welcome to Plot Spackle.
I'm John, and this is my Sean Connery impersonation.
I'm Eric, and this is my Sean Connery impersonation.
I'm Richard, and this is my Sean Connery impersonation.
And that's all our Sean Connery impersonations. You'll have to vote in the comments for whose is the best, or the worst.
Sometimes it's the same thing.
Alright guys, so we got a movie today, and we're going to fill its plot holes. And what do we have to fill the plot holes with? What are these?
Books?
It looks like repurposed literary characters. Is that like Rip Van Winkle laying on over there?
Look at all that public domain.
Alright, we're going to shove all these public domain characters into these plot holes for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
It came out, 2003 is when it came out.
So. Yeah, well, we talked about that. So, Eric, you've seen this movie, right?
I have seen this movie. I saw it in theaters, actually.
I saw it in theaters, too.
So did I.
Oh.
It looked... Let's just say...
It was so promising.
There was rose-tinted glasses there.
All right. So, what's this movie about, Eric?
All right, let me get my notes out. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is the ensemble movie everyone had been waiting for. The movie starts out with an old soldier being recruited for one last mission. The soldier is joined by a young hotshot foreigner, a technological genius, and a man who can change into a gigantic hulking monster due to a science experiment gone wrong. With the help of other lesser heroes, they convene on an unconventional ship to stop the villain you, let's be honest, really expected. After learning how to work as a team, they take down the pretty lesser villain and the villainous mind, and then save the day. They also did set up a sequel, which never happened, so there goes the Avengers analogies.
Yeah, it's no longer like the Avengers. It's just a separate ensemble film.
But I mean, if the Russo brothers had directed this one, it might have gone differently.
It probably would have gotten a sequel. It would have been a better movie. I mean, I think this would have been a better movie if they just had a better cinematographer.
Maybe if they didn't use so many fire gifs in the background.
Oh yeah, fire gifs.
Maybe they visited Michael Bay and gotten some real explosions.
Yeah, Michael Bay, he has extra explosions. If you're in Hollywood and you need an explosion for a film, just talk to Michael Bay. He'll probably do it pro bono.
You don't have to do bad CGI explosions, not with Michael Bay around.
All right, so tell us about this movie's technical aspects, Richard, and all other right. Fun facts.
So it was released on the 11th of July, 2003. Had a $78 million budget. It actually only earned $23 million in its opening weekend. Earned $66 million gross in the U.S. And if you get the cumulative worldwide, then you actually turn a profit at 179.
Wait, so what was the budget again?
$78 million.
Dang.
The entire gross in the U.S. did not cover the film's budget.
Oh, this is $78 million. Now I wonder what else has been made for $78 million.
78 million packs of gum.
But on a more interesting note, there is a scene in there where the actress who plays Mina Harker, Peeta Wilson, has to do a Sean Connery impersonation, and she was not super keen on it because Sean Connery impersonations were a big kind of taboo on set for obvious reasons, and so she wasn't very keen on doing it, and so she asked Sean Connery if she should go ahead, and he encouraged her to go with it, and when she did, she asked him how it was, and he's like, "It's great." She's like, "Really? Oh, yeah, it was perfect. That was the worst impression of me I've ever heard."
Which is, you know, words of praise from the man himself.
Okay, so what was the best Sean Connery impersonation, you guys think?
Definitely the guy they hired to do the celebrity blackjack telephone line.
See, I wanted to say it was Alec Baldwin in Hunt for Red October.
What about Nick Cage in The Rock?
I haven't seen The Rock.
Wait, now I'm wondering how many movies have a Sean Connery impersonation in them.
that also have Sean Connery.
I think a lot, but we should probably get into the plot holes.
We should get into the plot holes. That's what everyone's here for.
We'll talk about that in a Patreon post.
We'll have to do research.
We just have to watch a lot of Sean Connery movies.
There's a lot of them. He's been acting since
Time Bandits.
Like, even before that.
He can't have been in things before Time Bandits.
He was James Bond.
He was Darby O'Gill.
Yeah, he was in Darby O'Gill. Oh, he was so young.
All right, but time for them plot holes.
Hey, John, where are we getting our plot holes from?
We're getting these first ones from MovieMistakes.com.
And we're also getting some from IMDb.com. So, you know.
Two websites working twice as hard for you, our listeners. And here we go. When the team plays back the record that they find on the Nautilus, it contains an extremely high-pitched tone, which triggers the crystal sensors on the ship, which set off the bombs. But the speech on the record is low quality. And this low quality is a result of extreme frequencies being lost during the recording. So if there's poor audio quality, it means that these frequencies would be lost, and the whole plan to set off bombs with a high frequency trigger would not work. There we have it. Movie's over.
Well, let's see. They're using a phonograph record, so they're not really losing that much quality. I mean, obviously, M is an audiophile because he's choosing the superior format.
I think he's choosing the only format.
No. Those are not phonograph cylinders, so.
Oh, yeah, they have the cylinders first.
Yep. I mean, I don't even think, like, let's just say there's the technological advances in this movie are somewhat off. I don't think, like, the flat records had been invented until the 30s. So, yeah, I guess this movie, unwatchable.
Or, specifically, M was doing it as an artistic choice because he wanted something to distract them about various audio qualities so that they weren't paying attention to high-pitched subsonics that are out there to blow up, say, super-advanced submarines.
I also say maybe the audio problems come from the secondary layer they did for the high-ear frequencies, where damage happens to the disc when they're going through for the frequencies, because it takes a long time. I mean, is it like a 30-second counter on the bomb? It's got to hear the frequency.
I wonder if it's just the frequency going and it just keeps resonating until the resonance cascade reaches a critical point, and then it sets off the electrical charge that blows the bomb, or whatever however the timer works. It's kind of like you've seen those pictures of like the bridges that collapse because it's matching the
because the wind or marching troops going over it.
Yeah, and it doesn't break right at it doesn't collapse right at the beginning. It has to reach a certain point.
All right, so that's how the bombs work, we guess. So yeah, I think that the poor dialogue is an artifact of the production of hiding the supersonic or the subsonic sounds on it, or an artistic quality because, I mean, this is M, who's actually James Moriarty. Spoilers, and he's got a flair for the theatric. As does Dorian Gray.
Hence why he, like, even to the end, he runs around grabbing that stupid phantom mask.
Oh yeah, he's got to have the phantom mask.
Even after they know who it is, he still wants that mask.
Still gonna wear that mask.
It is like pure silver, man. You know how much that thing would cost?
No.
Well, I don't know either.
And none of us looked that up.
Failure, guys.
I'm guessing it's like at least $100 for a pound of silver.
At least $100.
And $100 was a lot back then. Or maybe not. I don't know. Probably inflation.
Well, let's deal with a real plot hole, not the cost of silver for James Moriarty.
Listen, we need to talk about the gold standard and the destruction it had on the American economy.
Look, we'll get to that when we cover Going Postal.
Oh, or Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I was going to say Wizard of Oz is another one, too.
Anyway, when we're showing the Nautilus's journey into Mongolia, and it has this big travel scene and goes down this river into it. Are we expected to believe that this very, very long ship could travel down this river, even though it has a lot of sharp turns in it?
Yes.
What scale are these sharp turns? Like, is this a person from Mongolia who spends their time walking up and down this river and saying to themselves, man, only small boats can go down this river? Or was it a person who, like, looked at the map and said, man, that is a really curvy river. I bet a boat couldn't go down that.
Now, are they in a harbor or are they in an actual... And we can set a marker if you want to actually just laugh.
Oh, I just had really, really horrendously racist thoughts.
Oh.
I'm like, we have to give that one to you, though.
I didn't have racist thoughts.
I know, but that's why I didn't say them.
He kept them on the inside, Eric. That's where your racism belongs.
on the inside.
I don't believe... Listen, people tell me not to keep my emotions bottled up, you know, where they belong. So anyways, whatever. We'll cut this,
yeah, probably. So, and the whole lap. All right. Yeah, so, I mean, where's the comparison for how sharp this river is? I mean, yeah, the submarine is pretty long, but it also is pretty durable and tough and punches through masonry and buildings. And so I think some dirt and silt and riverbank aren't really going to stop it. Heck, it cracks through Arctic ice.
Yeah, is it?
With the conning tower.
Yeah, with the conning tower. And it's just fine.
So is this an actual harbor or is it a lake, like somewhere in Mongolia?
It looks like it's a frozen lake.
Because I was like, if it's a harbor, that's not going to be a trouble for a submarine to get into it. But I mean, then they wouldn't have put river on there. I don't know.
I mean, I'd be more worried about if the river's deep enough. But the Nautilus looks like it can ride pretty high in the water. For whatever reason, whatever super science doctor or
Captain Nemo,
he's got to be a doctor too, right?
This is before standard.
I'm giving him an honorary doctorate
in what?
In shippery,
nautical husbandry.
All right,
from the plot.
I'll allow it.
Plot Spackle Academy of BS.
No, he got a bachelor's of science in the nautical husbandry.
Yeah. And then he got a doctorate afterwards. Yeah.
See, I think that much like he was able to get from Venice to outside of China almost instantly before this whole thing blew up, he was able to get into Inner Mongolia by traveling on the same route through the planet's core.
Oh, he took a journey through the center of the Earth?
Yes.
Oh.
Which is also public domain. Unlike that other thing I was referencing.
So he had his friend, whoever was like the main character of that book, because it's been a long time, told him about the center of the Earth. And Nemo's like, hey, I'm going to use that. Because, yeah, seriously, they get around really fast.
Yeah, that's mine now. It's like, but can I be on your team? No. You're going through the center of the Earth. Go fight your dinosaurs or whatever.
Yeah.
Otto Leidenbrock.
Oh, see, that's why he wasn't on the team. He was German. And they were at odds, I guess, at this time.
So there, like, they didn't really go through the river. They just went through the lava underneath the planet's core.
They just went through the went through that and bam.
Oh, and that's why the propellers are the
weird screws.
The screws, because going forward, it goes through water. Going reverse, goes through lava. I guess technically it's magma until it hits the surface.
Yes, John. Got to be scientifically accurate there.
Yes.
I was going to say, I don't know enough. I don't think that's right, but I don't know enough about geology to prove you wrong. So I'm going to just go with it right now.
That having propellers turn backwards allows you to go through magma?
Yeah. I mean,
they're drills now.
Oh, makes sense. Okay.
There you go.
Alrighty. But our next plot hole... When the Nautilus is in Mongolia, we are shown that there is deep snow everywhere. If this part of the movie takes place in July or August, why would there be any snow at all? Even the Yukon doesn't have snow in the summer, except for the northernmost portion of the province.
Now, I don't remember at any time when it said when in the year it was happening.
Because it only said the year, which is 1899.
The best thing we have for a timer is the timing for Carnival.
Yes, because in Venice, they're all wearing their masks, which is a famous thing.
And Sean Connery literally says, Carnival, so we know what festival it is.
And when is Carnival?
A Carnival happens at the end of Lent.
And when is that?
Usually in February.
That's not very summer months.
Well, maybe in, like, Argentina, you know, the southern hemisphere, the complete opposite direction of the northern, I guess.
So our only point of reference here for timing is Carnival, and that's in winter, not in the summer. So I'd expect that Mongolia has snow in the winter.
And to be fair, Mongolia will get snow like in the middle of July. It's one of those weird places.
Now, if you're wondering why it wasn't snowing in the UK, I went and looked up the weather that was in the UK in 1899.
Oh, I just want to say, because it's a temperate climate and sparrows migrate south for that?
It might be true, yes, yes. But specifically in those years, between 1895 and 1899, they had really light winters. with low or normal snowfall, according to weather.tv.com.
All right.
And now you know. So, when they have Hyde caught on the submarine, all the soldiers are getting pretty close to him, and they're like poking him with sticks, and they're getting smacked back and tossed around. I mean, why? Like, if you were on that submarine, would you be thinking, hey, I'm going to go poke that big guy and get close enough to get smacked by his big arms? That's worth the pay I get. Why are they putting themselves at risk to do this? I mean, he's chained up. He's captured. I don't think they're getting paid enough. This is definitely in the not getting paid enough scale to be getting there to get smacked around by this roided out Englishman.
Well, there's two things. One, he is definitely not securely chained, because we have the scene where he rips the bolt out of the wall and almost kills Tom Sawyer when he decides he really wants to make a point of this. So, chained up, certainly. Chained up where he can't get away? I'm going to say no on that. And also, maybe they just gotta have some way for him to let out all of this aggression before his formula wears off. And so, gotta send in somebody. These are the people that didn't sign, that signed all the waivers before reading the contract.
Ah, they felt stupid after that. But yeah, I think, yeah, he's not like taut or tied up well.
Because none of them wanted to get that close to him.
And if they stopped poking at him, he could focus on just ripping the chains out. And then he'd be just loose on the ship and break everything.
Which Nemo is definitely against.
Plus, I mean, when you're on the ship like that, what can you do for entertainment?
You go down to the rec room and play foosball.
Yeah, but there's only one foosball table.
I want to say they're on a ship, so they sing a jaunty sea shanty.
Yeah, but you do that when you're on duty, too. I'm saying that they just get bored, and if they have the chance to go poke a big guy and laugh about it, they're going to do it.
This is in the era where freak shows were still parts of things.
Yeah. And they just, like, put a bear and poke it with a stick, and that's your circus.
Have a bunch of moose boxing each other.
Yep.
Moose actually boxed each other? Like, I could see bears doing that, but moosing? Anyways, we'll have to look that up again as part of our Cabinet of Curiosities. Yeah. Oh, wait, no, can't use that name. That's copyrighted.
Our Curio of Curiosities.
Sounds good.
Or a Curio of Mysteries. Do we have some more plot holes?
We do, actually. Speaking of, you know, the Nautilus, there's the bit where it's going through Venice, and we can see in front of it a bridge that's too low for the Nautilus to go under at its current running depth. And then we cut inside, and then we cut back outside the Nautilus, and now we're past it.
I think that is an inaccurate description of the scene, as described.
Look, I'm just reading right off the webpage.
As when I was watching the film, I noticed that they reached the bridge and started going underneath it. While doing so, tearing away mortar and causing dust to fall down from the bridge as it went under. And immediately after, they say, "We can't go any further. Stop." Well, specifically, full ahead stop.
Sorry, John Rosa, calling you out on this.
Well, it says who's
We actually have a username for that one. Yeah,
John Rosa.
But please keep listening to our podcast, because apparently you are. No, from I don't know how long ago you wrote that.
So yeah, they couldn't go any further. Unless they wanted to break the bridge, which I think they could have done. But breaking Venice wasn't their goal. Except a little bit.
Yeah, they needed to blow up one building.
And only after everything else was blowing up anyway.
Yeah, it was because if you cause one explosion, it cancels out another explosion. And that is science, as described by Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen.
It's one of the sciences taught at a Plot Spackle Academy. For our next plot hole, though. So, after reaching the Arctic cave, the Invisible Man is suddenly completely clothed. With his makeup, glasses, and shoes on, he walked to the cave nude. Neither he nor any other character appears to be toting these items.
So, how did he get them in the cave?
Yeah, basically. Oh, also, somehow he doesn't freeze to death either.
Alright, so it looks like we have the 2 points. And one is his being completely clothed, is he's wearing the standard white jacket that everyone is wearing.
You gotta match the ensemble.
Like all the mooks who were helping carry stuff, like all the sailors that
even the main Nemo characters has. Were wearing that same kind of outfit. They probably had spares.
Yeah. I mean, and they're only, what, 200 yards, 200, 300 yards away from the Nautilus anyways. The cave's just their staging ground. And that leaves his glasses, which are glasses and can fit in someone's pocket.
Or his mouth.
Or his mouth. And the same with the face paint.
Or John.
Uh-oh. I don't know where I'm now.
He could have done it the way drug mules do.
Oh.
He could have eaten everything.
We'll leave it at that. How about that?
No, Richard's going to get in details now. He's gotten started.
See, guys.
He's gotten started.
Because I looked into this. I had to find out how much drug mules can actually fit in their body. And they can fit a surprisingly large amount. Like, really surprisingly. There have been some interesting red don't Google image search interesting studies done on how much you can fit inside the average human body. But one of the most interesting things that they have caught in drug mule stations was that somebody was actually swallowed an entire frozen chicken.
Well, curse my morbid curiosity. I'll get
the
back to you.
The more you know.
And I mean, you could probably wad up one of those into about the size of a frozen chicken. Especially, I mean, these are malleable clothes, so it would, you could actually fit those further into, like, the intestines, not just the stomach cavity.
So me.
And John's face just keeps getting more and more glassy-eyed.
So me, personally, I like to think that he just asked the people to bring him some extra clothes, because we know that he was in communication with them.
And he was going to come meet them.
So it's like, hey, bring me a suitcase, guys, and bring my stuff, please.
Yeah, like my glasses and my my cream, my face cream, because I didn't swallow them.
I'm not a drug mule.
Or
you and it sounds uncomfortable.
My universe, where he's used to operating on his own, had to do this to get to survive.
We want to keep it PG-13, okay?
Look, I just think the world
is invisible. You don't have to show it.
Now, for staying warm, I say we have 2 points for this. One is that he is used to operating in colder situations because his standard mode is naked.
Yep.
He's robbing houses in England. Naked. Winter, summer, rain.
And given that we know that the rest of the film also happens in February, when we run into him in England, it's February.
Yeah. So he's probably used to colder temperatures to an extent, which will get you so far. And then I'm going to posit that he is a very hairy man. He shaves his head, but his back, it's got to be hairy.
Let's see. I'm going to Google something really quick.
Like, you think you're walking past spider webs? Might be the Invisible Man. He might be right there.
You'd never know.
Let's see. So I just Googled how
with
hairy.
A stomach full of grease.
So looking on Google, it says, so I looked, how hairy is Ringo Starr? And it apparently says that he's really hairy. So,
all right.
Because that was the actor who played him.
How hairy is Ringo? Was that an easy Google search? Like, did it autofill?
I don't know. I use DuckDuckGo. But yeah, apparently they were quite hairy. So, solved.
Yeah, so he's just kind of like a hobbit meets a caveman. Gets a little bit of insulation. Just think about what you didn't see and be happy for it.
Yes, please be happy for all the things we didn't have to see.
But Richard looked at, apparently.
Look, the internet takes me weird places.
All right, do we have any more plot holes?
There is one more.
One more.
It's with Dorian. Oh, gosh. Come here, you stupid thing. Don't go to the Firefox homepage. Go to the IMDb page.
Technical difficulties.
That's okay. We can talk about Mr. Dorian Gray.
Yep. So Dorian Gray. So in his home, you can see the outline of a painting, which Sean Connery comments on. And he's like, you have a painting missing right there. Dorian Gray's like, oh, you're very observant. You don't miss anything. Ha ha ha, you know, pun on the fact that he's a hunter. But that's at perfect eye level. In the movie, if Dorian Gray sees his picture, he loses the powers of his invulnerability. So why would he have it, the picture, at eye level where he could see it every day?
Who says that's the picture that was in that spot?
I'm thinking that it was the picture there, even though the picture size is completely different, and so it probably wasn't the picture. But let's assume that it was Dorian, the picture of Dorian Gray. Maybe he had it there during the first few years of his life, where it was during his debauchery phase, and he was still able to see that the picture was changing, and then when it started getting too crazy...
When he saw, he could see the changes, and he looked at it and realized that the changes were catching up to him?
Then that's when he put it away. Because obviously in the book, you know, he can look at it all the time, and he can see the physical changes that happen because of his sinful lifestyle. But, you know, in this one, it assumes that by not looking at the picture, he doesn't realize any of the effects of that picture.
It doesn't catch up to him.
Exactly.
And so I still think that I bet, because you say like it's not the same shape or anything or size, that was just a different painting that had been taken down, because Dorian Gray likes paintings. And he's got a lot of them.
He has a lot of girl paintings up there. So I'm assuming they're a bunch of the people that he's had...
relationships with?
Yes. They're like his family, extended family.
Plus, how long has Dorian Gray been immortal?
It doesn't say exactly, but he says he's lived long enough to see empires become history.
Let's see.
So he could hang up basically any painting there and have the wallpaper be a different picture because he's been around that long.
Maybe he, because when he's there, like they show up, except for the bad guys are there also, and M had stolen his painting. So maybe he had taken that painting down. He was like, I'll trade with this one. It is worth quite a lot of money.
So apparently Dorian Gray isn't as old as he's led on to be.
Uh-oh.
The picture of Dorian Gray was originally published in July of 1890. So he can only be 9 years old.
See, but that's when the story was published.
Yeah, it's probably actually from like the 1600s.
You know, probably. I mean, the timing in this movie is somewhat different.
Like we said, all we know is based on what Dorian Gray said, that he's lived long enough to see empires become history. So...
And yeah, so... Plus, he's going to keep his painting covered, but somewhere where he knows where it is. Because otherwise it gets stolen, and then people blackmail him into doing things.
That would be terrible.
I mean, he's got to know where it is so he doesn't look at it.
Plus, I mean, how often does he actually look at the paintings in his own home? I mean, you just know what's on your walls. You don't really look at them.
I'm trying to think, because there was that Instagram about the guy who, like, put a fake picture in his parents' house.
I think it took him, like, a couple weeks to notice. Was it the one where he put, like, Nicolas Cage all over the pictures?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they took forever to notice. Or the painting that was hung up in the McDonald's of the two friends.
Yeah. And it's it takes a while for these things to get... And so, I mean, he could just have it there. He knows where it is. He doesn't have to look at it.
Especially if it's off to one side and it does have, like, a covering over it where you have to specifically pull the drapery off. Maybe by some other paintings he doesn't like to look at because they're ugly. But they were on sale.
All right. Sounds good to me.
All right. So what are our thoughts on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
So I'm just trying to think of what I actually thought of it. For me personally, there was definitely some rose-colored glasses going or remembering this movie. Because like I said, I saw it in theaters. I actually enjoyed it in theaters. Not enough to actually buy it, though.
It was an action film, and I remember a friend being like, oh, you gotta watch this movie, it's pretty cool. And then, like, that first explosion of the plantation building or mansion or whatever it is in Africa, I'm like, this is some bad special effects. And I wasn't surprised much while watching it. And it has not aged well.
I thought it was a really cool concept, getting the literary characters together as, like, a super team.
Yeah, conceptually it's all right. But, I mean, it was a comic book beforehand.
Yeah.
Arguably, though, the comic book did better than this, as it got sequels.
Is it still going?
I think it's still ongoing, yeah. Because I remember reading a news article about like comic book movies and that didn't take off, and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was one of them. They mentioned, but people still like the comic, and it's ongoing. But I don't know how long ago that article was. So
what I find interesting is because you talked about at the beginning about the Avengers and how it's kind of the cycle, because superheroes come from these archetypes created or shown in these books and as literary devices and tropes, and then they come back round. So, you know, you get your the Great Incredible Hulk, who's based off of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And so the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the movie is based off the Incredible Hulk. So, like, comes back round.
They just need to paint him green.
Yeah, he should have just been green.
Or no, he should have been gray, because that was the original Hulk
color. Yeah, he should have been the gray. Yeah, Hyde should have been gray.
They did have that red Hulk, though, so...
I think he was just angry. And maybe easier to CG, because the Mr. Hyde is practical effects, but the Super Hyde character is CG.
Yeah, I was going to say, some of the Hulk, Hyde effects are definitely CG, but it's mostly like when he's getting thrown through walls and whatnot.
Yeah. I think some of the worst bits for this movie was actually cinematography.
Yeah.
And editing, like layers. Like, I don't like the flash cuts and flashing and the shaking with the transformations for Hyde. Or the very end with the ritual that the shaman's doing.
Where he's summoning the rains down in Africa.
Yeah. And like the layers just don't mesh well with the colors and the lighting. It just doesn't look good.
Well, they only had $78 million to work with.
Yeah, only $78 million.
In 2000s money.
How much of that went into Sean Connery's pocket is my question.
Well, he retired from acting after this, so...
I don't think it was because he got paid a lot. But, I mean, he was the probably... Like, I'm not sure I recognize many of the other actors from anything else at all, really. Or know where they went after this. Where are they now? Where did they go?
Listen, well, at the end of the episode, we'll have that Animal House style ending where we'll just cut to scenes of pictures of each of the characters and then a short bio of where they ended up.
Yeah, but it's going to be visual. We'll have postcards. You'll just have to imagine in your head what they say. Any final thoughts, Richard?
I definitely enjoyed the movie more back when I watched it in...
when you were young, when refined young. And teenage.
I enjoyed things more then. I was less cynical, less jaded. But it's interesting. I think it would probably do better. It's one of those ones where I'm like, if they could erase this movie from the cultural zeitgeist and do it now, I think they'd do a better job.
See, I don't think they'd do well, though, because they're like, oh, it's just an Avengers clone. And then...
See, I feel that it was in the wrong era, just because if it had come out like 5 years later, think of all the memes. But it's from that time period where we just don't have memes.
I guess GeoCities was still a thing, so yeah, no. It was Web.1 or whatever it's called.
Yeah, see, we lost a generation of memes. This movie is that kind of bad.
The internet never forgets, so I'm sure we could bring it back.
Yeah, but the internet does stop caring after a while.
After like a couple days. But yeah. They declare victory and then it's...
Once you've won, right?
Of course. EA totally folded after that boycott of Battlefront 2.
Yeah.
I mean, their value of their stock has fallen.
And jumped back up month later.
Like recently is pretty low.
Oh, so it was just a delayed tactic.
Yeah.
You know, for the 2 or 3 years.
Which is, as people start going, oh, EA, we're getting tired of you.
Well, contractually, we need to say EA is the literal worst. I'm going to make you sign contracts.
But no more about video games. We're talking about movies. About a movie, and I think we might actually be done talking about that movie.
I think we are, too. I mean, it was an okay movie. It was a basically mediocre, and there's not much to talk about.
Yeah. Like, it had potential. It failed. It was... overblown budget that wasn't well used. Like, I really feel like the fires would have been better.
They should have just lit actual fires.
Just lit actual fires would have been cheaper than doing the CGI fires, and it would have looked better. And if they put some effort into it, they could have gotten some great transformation scene for Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde and back.
See, I think like the practical effects were, they looked actually really good, but it was undercut by all the quick cuts in the editing. But like the actual makeup they used looked fairly good, I think.
They just didn't have, I think they planned though for the quick cuts. Because I don't think there were stages where it could change.
No.
It was just, you know, there's midpoint makeup, full makeup.
It's just, this is how we're going to do it. Okay, we'll base the editing around that and done. Well, maybe we'll get this back soon. They just need to make a shared universe. Maybe they can join the guy who made the time machine.
Or that new Mummy remake. They can be part of the Dark Universe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, word on that, actually.
Ooh,
The Dark Universe is continuing.
With what?
Blumhouse Films is acquired the Dark Universe from Universal.
Nice.
And they're starting off with The Invisible Man.
Ooh, nice. So we get Skinner.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Going to be part of the Dark Universe. And so called it.
Blumhouse is the smaller studio that does stuff like Insidious or Get Out.
Oh, okay. So it's going to be like scary stuff.
It'll be probably. Scary, but they're also used to making worthwhile films, or at least money-making films, off of smaller budgets.
I mean, it's just probably going to be... I don't know what the actual budget in return was for Hollow Man, but... I think that one was pretty. Pretty scary.
As effects go, invisibility is a really cheap one.
You just have to have someone talking to a blank spot.
Let's see. Oh, Happy Death Day.
Anyways, we should save those for the Halloween episodes, though.
Is Get Out from Blumhouse, or am I? Did I just say that one? Did I credit it? All right, it is. Yeah. So, I guess this is the end of the episode.
We just need to call down the rains of Africa. While we watch Mount Olympus rise over the Serengeti like Kilimanjaro,
Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus.
Over the Serengeti, and, that's right.
Here's our farewells, where you need to like us on Facebook and leave a comment about our Sean Connery impersonations.
Whoever votes for me, I was going to make another promise I shouldn't have, but...
Whoever votes for me can feel good about themselves.
But also, don't forget to comment on our Twitter. Maybe we'll actually use that. I know we check it, but we only have like 6 followers, so.
And we don't comment much, to be honest.
No.
Only when we're doing bargain bin roulette.
So maybe we should comment more.
But let's see.
And you can also shoot us an email at plotspacklepodcast@gmail.com. And make sure to tell your friends about Plotspackle and that they can find us on Apple Podcasts. Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify.
Anywhere where podcasts of various quality are available.
We'd also like to give a shout out to our patron members. You know, we really appreciate you and what you do for us. And, you know, we're glad that you, liked us enough to give us money.
Thank you. Yes, you.
You know who you are.
And also thanks to the Fat Rat for letting us use his song Epic for our intro music. You guys should listen to it, like the whole song.
In its entirety.
And more of his stuff, because it's good. You win. You get my super atomic pen.